At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Imagine seeing colors when you hear music, tasting flavors when you read words, or feeling textures when you listen to voices. Welcome to the fascinating world of synesthesia. But synesthesia isn't just a trick of the senses. It is a window into how diverse, creative, and beautifully complex our human minds can be. That's the everyday reality for people with synesthesia. A unique blending of the senses that often goes unnoticed or misunderstood. In today's episode, we are diving deep into this world with Micah, a psychologist, synesthesia artist, and an advocate for the neurodivergence. Together, we will uncover what synesthesia really is, how it shows up in everyday life, and how it intertwines with other neurodivergent traits like ADHD and autism. Whether you identify yourself as a neurodivergent, know someone who does, or are simply curious to learn something new, this conversation invites you to rethink the way we define perception, creativity, and our minds. So grab your favorite drink, get comfortable, and let's dive into the world of this uniquely wired brain. Hello, Micah. Welcome to my podcast, and I'm so thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here.
You have a podcast on synesthesia where you bring experts, you share your knowledge, and you share incredible stories. Before we dig deep into what is it and learn more about it, I want to start off by asking you your personal journey with synesthesia, and when did you realize for the first time you have it?
I found out I had synesthesia when I was 9 or 10, and synesthesia is very diverse. There are a lot of different forms. So I experienced all of them my whole life, but I only knew about this one form when I was younger. And then the other ones kind of came to me as I was reading more and saw more on the internet when I was in my mid-20s. And here I am talking about synesthesia on my podcast and on Instagram, explaining people what it is.
What were the certain things you heard while growing up which made you find it funny or just plain outright impolite?
I never had really negative experiences with my synesthesia and other people's reaction. I think the most common one is that people think it's just made up and like having a lot of fantasy, which it's not. It's more than that.
What are some practical challenges? Do you face it or still facing it, or you can overcome it? Please take us through a stretch of this.
Due to my synesthesia, I sometimes confuse letters and numbers because they have the same color. So S, for example, is pink and 3 is pink too. So when I was doing math problems, for example, it was difficult to remember. Once they introduced letters to it, it was really difficult to copy the calculation from the board to my paper. Besides that, I think my main struggle is overstimulation. As a very sensitive neurodivergent person, I just get overstimulated very quickly and it feels awful. And that's kind of a pain to manage all day, every day. And I'm sure synesthesia adds to that.
Over a period of time, have you learned to recognize your triggers and try to deal with it, or how do you handle it?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a psychologist myself and I work with neurodivergent clients, and that of course helped me also from a personal perspective, learning how to cope with stressors and whatever dysregulates me. So I think there's some professional knowledge in this, and then just from experience, and then also from conversations with other neurodivergent people and from books and stuff. And I definitely feel like I have a good basket of different tools now, and I wished I had it earlier. Definitely. But yeah, there's still so much to learn. You know, the world is so loud and fast and ever changing that your toolbox has to be too.
How was your family support while you were growing to this?
I would say really good. My family, of course, because there's a genetic component. Some of them are neurodivergent too. I come from a very sensitive family and I was always listened to and respected and taken care of. And especially my mom did a lot of research to support me in the best way possible while being very sensitive herself. So I'm pretty lucky in that regard.
That's great to hear when you have a support system so close and always for you. It makes a huge impact and help.
Definitely.
Does this, your personal experience, inspire you to take up this as a profession and dive deep into this and bring awareness?
Definitely, yes. But then the path of our lives is never linear. So it wasn't really what I set out to do. I just wanted to study psychology because I was interested in the brain. I didn't really think I would work with clients in the end, but I'm loving it. I'm self-employed at the moment. I worked at a facility before and just really loved helping people get some autonomy and just life quality back with whatever we as a service had to offer. And now, as I'm more, the things I do are more global and more like I'm more of an advocate, I guess, with a podcast and my Instagram account. So yeah, I'm definitely inspired by my own journey and experience with it, and just knowing that things can be a lot more fun and we can find our potential easier when we know certain resources and vocabulary and coping skills.
Okay, now let's get into the topic. And could you please explain what is synesthesia and give some examples?
So synesthesia is a neurodivergence, which means it's a neurological makeup. So your brain is wired in a way that differs from the neurotypical brain. The neurotypical brain would be the most common brain type or neurotype. So synesthesia is a sort of a byproduct of human evolution. So we as a species, we have different body height, different noses, different fingers, and we also have different brains, of course. We just differ as a human species. And neurodiversity is one way or one word to describe those differences that we have neurologically. Some other neurodivergent traits would be autism, ADHD, dyspraxia, dyscalculia. And synesthesia is under this neurodiversity umbrella, but it's not a disability or a pathology, and you wouldn't find it in any diagnostic manual. It's just a difference, and a lot of people describe it as a gift or a superpower. I'm a bit more neutral with my understanding, just because I think it's like a byproduct of our brain developing over millions of years, but you can certainly use it as a gift. That's kind of what synesthesia is neurologically. I think I should mention that synesthesia comes down to sort of a double reaction of the senses. So in a synesthetic brain, when the brain is triggered by one stimulus, like a sound or a smell or whatever, not only one brain area gets activated, but a second. So if I hear someone closing a door, it's not just my auditory part of the brain that gets activated by that, but also my visual cortex, because there's some neural connection that usually doesn't exist anymore, because through that whole neuropruning process that our brains go through in childhood, we lose those extra connections. So a synesthetic brain is on average more connected. So it reacts to one stimulus with multiple reactions.
You said that there are 20 forms of it. What are the most common types?
There are over 80, actually. Some people say there are even over 100. I experience around 10 different forms, so I'm just going to mention some of these. Grapheme color synesthesia is one. I mentioned it before. It's when colors and numbers are connected, or letters, numbers, and colors. So your name, for example, is pink, white, and red for me mainly. And when I see it on the screen, I know it's written in white, but I kind of see like a color layer on top of it because my brain perceives your name as color. Another one would be music. So a lot of artists have what is called chromesthesia, or music to color synesthesia. Pharrell Williams, for example, Billie Eilish, Beyonce, they all, I'm sure their music is influenced by how they see music visually due to their synesthesia. Another one would be tasting words. So some people have a connection to taste. So whenever they, for example, hear my voice, they would taste paprika or something else, or hairspray. Very random connections. So that's another one, and that maybe impacts life a bit more deeply. Another one is sequence space synesthesia, where when you imagine time or sequences of numbers, like the numbers from 1 to 100 or the year, you see it arranged in space around you or in front of you. So those are some forms.
Are there any serious forms where it needs help, like an external help?
Good question, because that's kind of what I'm trying to provide. I think the majority would say synesthesia is mainly a positive thing. But I think especially since synesthesia is much more common in autistic people, it can add to the overstimulation. So yeah, I think it depends on the whole neurocomplexity, whether synesthesia is something that a person feels like they want to manage it. But so in my practice, I mainly use it for whatever they have going on. We use the colors, we use systems that just feel like their innate language. But that being said, there's one form, it's called mirror touch synesthesia, or mirror pain. That's where you feel the touch or the pain you perceive in other people in your own body. And that can be, of course, very difficult. It's when your mirror neurons are so blurry that they can't really distinguish if what I perceive is happening to you or to me. And they just fire regardless. And then, of course, there's a lot more risk in a day to experience pain because other people experience, or like watching violent movies and stuff. So this one is a bit difficult, as we just live in a world where there is a lot of stuff to see on TV and politics, and you know, just a lot to see on TV and in real life. Yeah, but even that, I mean, if we all had mirror touch synesthesia, the world would be a much better place, because it's just empathy put to an extreme. You know, it's incredible. If we would all feel what other people feel, we would be much kinder, much nicer. So the thing itself is definitely not a disability. It's maybe disabling in the world we live in, and because we're not all wired that way. But if we would all be wired that way, we would just have a much more peaceful world. So
yeah, for sure.
It always depends on the context, doesn't it?
Yes, it truly. What are the misconceptions you have?
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Frequently heard while you were, you know, treating neurodivergent adults, or when you're doing a research.
It's more the internet is sometimes a bit unhinged. So my co-host and I were on the internet to advocate for like our synesthetic experience and stuff. And my co-host is on YouTube, and that's, I think, where we get the most like confused comments of synesthesia being a hallucination or sort of schizophrenia, which is just clinically incorrect. So it just comes from a very uneducated place, which I understand partly because hallucinations are an extra perceptual phenomenon. Like you experience kind of what we all quote unquote experience, and then you have something on top, which I understand synesthesia can be misunderstood as that, but just neurologically, they're two different things. It's just annoying when people just want to, they just comment because they want to hurt you, and that's just nasty. But it's not really hurtful because it's just so clinically incorrect. And then the other misconception is that synesthesia just doesn't exist. So it would be the other extreme. It's just we all have fantasy, or you're just making it up, that kind of thing, where in reality is a quite well-studied neurological trait. And you can Google it. You know, there's a lot of resources now. Always either way, like either you're crazy or you're just making up. So you're crazy too.
Yeah, it is such a delicate thing for a person who's experiencing it. But for somebody who don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you think synesthesia doesn't exist because everybody experiences that, I just want to say no. And maybe you are one of us. Like, if you think everybody sees pain in colors, no. Actually, most people see nothing. And if that is your experience, then this is a topic to look into and not to talk down on.
How can a person address to these common misconceptions when they themselves are facing it? How can they address them to the society?
Good question. I always like to say it's, like I just said, a well-studied neurological trait. I think vocabulary helps a lot. I think it helps a lot to hear other people explain it and just kind of develop your own way of explaining it. So I think this is definitely part of why I created a podcast, because once you hear other people explain it in their own words, you find a language that works for you. So yeah, I think exploring it a bit more beforehand, and then in the moment, just using that, like how sure you are about it, referring to other people's stories, referring to research labs, maybe giving them a resource, or just say, you know, I did my research and I kind of don't want to argue about this right now. It is also an okay way to respond, because if someone wants to misunderstand you, they're gonna. But yeah,
I think they would do it eventually. If they want to misunderstand you, they would.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think it's just having those resources and understanding that it is real for yourself. And then I think it's much easier to stand up for yourself, because if you're not sure about it, you know, it's difficult to argue.
Is there a connection between synesthesia and other neurodivergent traits like autism and ADHD? Can it mix, or what's the relation between these?
So synesthesia is almost 3 times more prevalent in the autistic population, which means there's definitely a neurological link between the two. They're two completely different traits. But I mean, just from what we see and how common it is in autism, there's definitely some maybe shared cognitive profile or just some link between the two. And then for ADHD and synesthesia, there is, to my knowledge, no study showing that there is a connection. But since autism and ADHD cluster together so heavily, it's very likely to believe that also synesthesia and ADHD have a connection. Just, yeah, it almost can't be any other way. And then a lot of synesthetes are also gifted, are very sensitive, have high scores for creativity and memory. And those are kind of, yeah, some of them overlap with other neurodivergent traits, but it's definitely a good thing to know about yourself if you have synesthesia.
In the last, I think, 5 to 7 years, the word autism and ADHD has gained its popularity. And there is always a gap between the fact and the not so true aspects of it. Do you think that going forward, talking about it can reduce the gap? Why I ask this question is, sometimes these topics are only spoken about, or they are or they show interest if one of the family members is around. Otherwise, it is not talked in that whole family or in that whole social circle where nobody has an experience. So how would you think that we can reduce this gap?
So your observation is that when there is a family where there's one person who, for example, has ADHD, then the social circle does talk about it. But if that person didn't exist or wasn't part of that circle, they wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, raising awareness, I think social media, of course, has its downsides, but it's also a great place to hear from people firsthand, which we didn't have before. Just, you know, so many content creators authentically sharing what it's like to be ADHD or autistic. I think that's incredible. We just have to also believe it and relate to it and feel what I feel to understand what it is like and kind of relate it to our own experience. So I don't have ADHD, but I know how annoying some of the things are that just happens as a human being. And if I imagine those to be dialed up to the extent of someone who has ADHD, I can kind of relate and get an idea of how debilitating it can be to have ADHD. Motivation and intention to understand it and relate it to myself, not dismiss it. I think it's a really hard topic, especially with ADHD, it being so misunderstood and so many people claiming it being a trend. And I can see where that is coming from. But what I especially want to point out is we missed so many people because we didn't know what ADHD and autism looked like in girls and women. And now all we focus on is it being potentially overdiagnosed. But nobody's worried about underdiagnosing it. Nobody's worried about suicide rate in autistic people. You know, it's amazing that we're talking about it and catching up. And it's pretty annoying to just see people going the other way around and again, just bashing.
Yeah, you bring up a good point because this is something I personally get irked, to be very honest, is when they loosely use the term. I have ADHD in this, you know, just like going, oh, I'm depressed. Clinically, it holds such a valuable or a heavy meaning to it, but it is used so casually. So that's the biggest downside of the topics which comes up like this. Do you share the same opinion? You differ?
No, I understand what you mean. I think whenever pop culture picks up on anything that's, you know, is vocabulary of a different field, it's kind of icky to hear someone say, oh, I can't drink tequila, I still have PTSD from my last night out, like from drinking or smelling tequila. I get it, and I get like how we want to put humor we use extreme terms to kind of bring a joke across. At the same time, it is really annoying if you have PTSD, which is such a severe response to something really, really traumatic happening in your life, and hearing other people just misuse it for whatever comes your way is, you know, it's not really helpful because we just wash it down like narcissistic men. Like, you can read and hear about it all the time everywhere. And yeah, I'm not telling anybody anything new here. I think it's just important terms that hold a lot of clinical meaning, and then we just use them for whatever. Also means that we do kind of have an idea of what these terms are, and maybe before we didn't. So overall, I think it's amazing people know more about OCD and autism and all those conditions. But of course, I wished we didn't overuse it.
Yeah. And it also means that when somebody has an actual PTSD or an emotional trauma or anything, because of the pop culture, you said, we are kind of reducing the severity of the term.
Mm-hmm. I would hope that in the right context, people still understand, like if someone would open up about their PTSD diagnosis, that they would still understand that there is a difference to their tequila night. But of course, you're right. We wash it down, kind of the severity. That's true. Yeah, I hope the context does something to it, though.
Yeah, that's a hope we can live in.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a difficult topic. I mean, I wouldn't wish the internet away.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah.
Those, yeah, pop cultural phenomena are definitely interesting to observe and kind of understand. And I think my difficulty is a bit here. I worked and studied in the psychological field for maybe 15 years now, and it's just difficult to imagine what it's like using those words. Like, even if I would make a joke about me being OCD, which I don't, but even if I would, I feel like I would just know what I meant. I know what it actually means. And I just can't really imagine what it's like when you really have no clinical knowledge to back it up with. What's going on in someone who says, I have onions on my burger, give me a trauma response. I don't know. I would be like, there, people experience such horrible things, and you really shouldn't say that. Just say something else, like it gives you the ick, or I don't know. There are other pop cultural words we can use.
Or just it annoys you. It can be you can use those simple words. I think self-awareness or being knowledgeable is the key to go ahead, I think.
And often we also need to hear someone talk about it, right? Because we just don't. We don't feel like this is actually hurting anybody, and unless we've talked to a good friend who was maybe sexually abused and we understood what this world looks like all day, every day, or we had a partner who had ADHD and we actually saw the other side of it, and then we get more, have more empathy for the words we use, and we become a bit more aware. If we don't have those stories and contacts, and I hope that just people sharing their stories so vulnerably on podcasts and on the internet helps us put it all a bit in perspective.
Yeah, totally.
And makes us pick our words more with more empathy. Yeah,
certainly there is a change, but I'm happy about it that people are okay to speak about. There's a good medium. How can one find out if they have synesthesia or not? If you're enjoying this episode, make sure to follow Discovering Journeys so you never miss an inspiring journey. And if this conversation has sparked something in you, consider sharing it with your loved one who might need to hear it, or share it on your social media. Now, let's get back to our guest's incredible journey. And for more details, please check the show notes and our disclaimer. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. So there is no diagnostic manual, as I said. So you wouldn't go to a doctor, but you can go online. There are some good resources. There are some synesthesia test batteries. I think I've used one before. I'm not sure. If they work for every form, I think researching is really the right thing. There are a couple of really good books, like the Oxford Handbook of Synesthesia, or there is a website called thesynesthesiatree.com, where a lot of synesthesia forms are listed, like a lot. A really good resource with like quotes and anecdotes and definitions. And I think our podcast is very helpful too, in just the library of other people sharing their story. If you want to do tests at home kind of thing, I think that's pretty important, because the synesthesia has to be stable over time. So if you, for example, write down your association with colors and letters, you can pick maybe on your computer a very good color nuance for whatever M is for you, for example, and then you check it 6 months later, you do the same thing, and then you compare it. So one of the big criteria is consistency over time, which you can kind of test yourself at home with if you wanted. And then there's one more difficult to access and maybe more expensive way to identify synesthesia, which is a brain scan. So you can see synesthesia on a brain scan. And it's so funny you're saying you're in France, because I did randomly a synesthesia brain scan at a research institute in Toulouse.
Ah, in Toulouse. That's good.
And I've never been before. So yeah, it was just pretty random. It was a very small study, and they scanned my brain, and we could see my synesthesia in action on the fMRI brain scan. That was really exciting. But again, that's if I wouldn't have had this student who wanted to go for exactly this method, I wouldn't have had access to an fMRI.
From your experience, and you have heard so many people speak about this synesthesia, are there a certain pattern to it that people can associate?
Can you give an example?
Like, for example, people with OCD, okay, they have a pattern of being relentlessly stuck to something. It could be organizing or keeping it neat, or I mean, I'm speaking very low forms of it, but OCD goes to more severe. So something, a common pattern, so a relentless and obsessive of to one particular thing. So like that, have you have found a pattern?
Yeah, I think that is a difficult question to ask for such a diverse trait, because if we think there are 100 synesthesia forms, even if you pick 100 people who have the same form, they will still experience it in a different way. So I have some auditory visual synesthesia. So some instruments, music, sounds, voices have colors, shapes, and textures. But then for my podcast co-host, she sees very different things compared to what I see. And then every other friend I have also sees other things. So even within that group, we have very different experiences. I do remember there was one girl in Mexico who did her PhD thesis on whether there is a connection, like a reoccurring pattern of how we perceive sounds. Like sort of some common in how we perceive those cross-modal phenomenon. But when I interviewed her, she was at the beginning. So I feel like I have to ask her if she found anything. And then maybe besides that actual synesthetic concurrence, though, this shared cognitive profile, I think, is the most like common ground that a lot of synesthetes have high scores for: creativity, good memory, are very sensitive, and not just interpersonal, but sensitive to sound and sensitive to light or smell or color perception. So a lot of that, I think, is a pattern within the synesthetic community. For giftedness, I'm not quite sure, but I do know a lot of synesthetes are gifted too. It's not necessarily linked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is so much of research still. Is it ongoing, or where do you think in a percentage wise, like the understanding of this whole topic is?
That's a nice question. I don't know how much we know about the brain. So if we know like 0.5% about the brain,
there is still so much.
Well, I guess it's like, I don't know what number it is, but really we don't know that much about the brain. But I'm guessing, please don't think that there's, I really don't know, but I know it's not that much. The things we do know are profound, but still it is a very mysterious kind of organ to us that is quite difficult to study. And then synesthesia being a small thing within what we know about the brain, I cannot put any numbers on it, to be honest, but there are fantastic research labs around the world. There's a good one in Sussex in Brighton in the UK, I know people in Amsterdam and Germany, Australia, the US are looking into synesthesia. Still a lot to be discovered.
Are there any few words that you shouldn't address or say to a neurodivergent individuals which are just impolite?
Interesting. Okay, so not just synesthesia, just like neurodivergent people.
Yeah.
It's a kind of language we use and don't use anymore. Mm-hmm. There are a couple like high functioning, like any functioning labels is something that we don't really use anymore. For autism, for example, you wouldn't say high functioning autism, which is someone who has low support needs. That's what we use now, low and high support needs, because it just like the functioning labels are just really ableist and just not okay. I mean, I get where they came from with this vocabulary, but it's just we can do better than that, because we also know that intelligence, for example, is not easily assessed with the standard IQ test we have for autistic people, like non-speaking autistic people. Can not access a regular IQ test, and then we would think, oh, they're low functioning in that sense too, which is absolutely not true. So low and high support needs is our terms that we use more. And then Asperger's, for example, is also it used to be one like form of autism, which is now not used anymore. It's autism level 1 to 5. But a lot of people who've been diagnosed with Asperger's still use it. I think there's some sort of connection to a medical doctor, Hans Asperger, who was involved in Nazi times. I don't know about his ideology. It's just not a good namesake. And therefore, the newer diagnostic manuals also got rid of that. For synesthesia, I think the words we wouldn't use are condition, disability, that kind of thing. Just, yeah. I mean, if it's disabling to yourself, absolutely feel free to use it, of course. But in general, we say a neurological trait, neurological phenomenon. But the condition word is actually really interesting, because for me, it's as a non-native English speaker, condition is quite neutral. So it depends on the context. If someone would say they have some medical condition, I would understand it's a medical thing. But I could also see condition just being like a state. But if you were to write a text about synesthesia, calling it a neurological condition, and you would then translate it to German, condition would without a doubt be translated to Erkrankung, which is illness or disease. And then in that translation thing, which is maybe, AI or whatever translation you use, you change the meaning of what you intended to say, because condition is a bit ambiguous.
Yeah, it is.
But then again, I think you shouldn't be so scared about having no negative connotation to, like, we don't have to have it so pure. It's okay to be disabled. It's okay to struggle. It's not like, oh my God, I'm not going to touch these words. It's okay either way.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's always good to know. And I think the words are also evolving over a period of time, because high functioning, as you say, was very much valid like a decade ago. And we are also understanding its symptoms and how they navigate and how it affects a person. So we're coming up with new names as well.
Exactly. No, and especially high functioning, like high functioning depression. If someone says that, I know exactly what they're talking about. I think it's more the low functioning is stigmatizing and just doesn't take into account how complex someone's life is. And that low functioning is just really not the right term to describe their situation. Well, high functioning depression, I think, conveys more of what we were trying to say.
Do you think we can reduce the gap of knowledge in the society?
Well, with every new piece of knowledge, we also know less about the same thing. I want to hope yes. But I mean, I will never know everything I want to know. There's so much knowledge. But I think we can actively in our lives for certain areas and topics definitely make an effort to be part of the solution and educate ourselves.
From your own experience of having synesthesia, how have you used it as your power?
So since every word and letter has a color, I definitely used it just automatically to learn languages. So if I would have to learn vocabulary, I would just remember the English word is red, and therefore I know it starts with an A. So I just remember the first bridge was always a color, and then I would remember the word from there. Then also remembering like PIN codes, phone numbers. I always remember everything in a color code. That's definitely helpful, but it's not like I learned to use it as a strength, because it was more like my default. And then later on, as I understood what synesthesia was, I realized that that's what I'm doing. Or I think the more mind-blowing thing is that you realize other people don't do it. Like that's like, oh my God, how? I literally can't understand how other people learn languages if not through color. Like, how do you just read it, remember it, and know it? That's incredible.
Yeah. For me, it is on the other side. It's incredible when you said that you have a color code. And I'm like, okay, is your creative brain very much active so you can do it? So for me, it is like quite fascinating. Did it help you in creativity?
I think I was always just very creative. It's just what I thrive in. Yeah. What I do now, when I make art, it's to communicate what synesthesia is like for me. So what I do is synesthesia art. So for example, I got a tattoo, a tiny one on my finger for a video on Instagram. And well, I wanted to get it anyways, but I did film it to see kind of what the pain of getting a tattoo looks like. And then I would create that on my laptop, recreate kind of what it looked like in my mind's eye. So that's kind of my creative outlet at the moment. But yeah, I cannot imagine what it's like to not be creative. And I'm realizing it sounds a bit like full of myself, I feel like, because creativity is such a positive, like the connotation is so positive that I feel like, oh God, I'm showing off. But it is just a case that I think I got a creative brain and I love it and use it. Yeah, and I think the synesthesia just adds a couple layers to it, because I'm very just neurologically used to connect different things. Like if someone would explain to me that they want in this artwork have something that reminds them of the smell of cinnamon, and then it would make sense that something visually can be connected to a smell or any other senses connected. Whereas I think for someone who's creative but doesn't have synesthesia, maybe they would be like, oh, what are you talking about?
Yeah. What is one fascinating thing you learned about and it blew your mind?
So I interviewed one friend actually from India who he's autistic and has a very difficult time detecting emotions in other people. And I keep telling the story because I find it so interesting. He realized later, well, in his 30s, that even though he can't detect other people's emotions when they speak, like if they would say, if I have news for you, he wouldn't know if it is happy or sad news. But his synesthesia allowed him to see colors when they speak. So the sentence would kind of have a color while they speak. And he could read the saturation level. And from the saturation of the color, understand their emotion, which is an incredible solution or just innate way of his brain to used information that was perceived, use it in his system, and he just had a bit of a longer time to decode it, because it wasn't taught to him that dark red means sad and light red means happy. So he had to kind of figure that out by himself. But once you know how to maybe also use your synesthesia to help with social differences, I think that can be a really amazing tool.
Before I end it, I forgot to ask you one question which I had. Mm-hmm. Is neurodivergence different for male and female?
So that is a big question.
I kept the best for the last.
So how do I answer this in simple terms? We are socialized in, most of the time, male and female. And those gender terms hold so much like stereotypes and expectations. And therefore, we have different expectations from a boy compared to a girl. And therefore, even though they're both autistic and or both ADHD, they, of course, know and feel what the world wants from them. And they're treated differently because of those gender stereotypes. And therefore, we do see that autism and ADHD show differently. And maybe there is also a genetic component to the whole thing. I'm not too sure about that. So I don't want to say anything that's incorrect here, but I think the whole social construct of gender just plays a lot into how those conditions actually do. So I wouldn't say there's male ADHD and female ADHD. I think that that's not something I would use. But we do see that women were underdiagnosed in both autism and ADHD. And then, of course, it raises the question of why was it so invisible? You know, how did our society make it invisible in, how do the expectations maybe camouflage the actual struggles of women with those traits? So it's a whole complex question. And then there's of course, trans and non-binary people who have, again, either a similar or a different experience to the whole thing. So complicated question to ask. I can't give you a good answer.
Okay, no problem. We are towards the end, and I would like to ask you my three questions as a takeaway for the listeners.
Awesome.
For someone who has been recently discovered that they are neurodivergent individual of any sorts, what are the first steps they can take to help themselves?
I mean, you're addressing a very important topic here, because neurodivergent people often post-diagnosis are just left alone. And I think it's getting maybe better now, but I would look for a psychologist or therapist or coach that does know what neurodiversity is. If you're female, do look for on Google for words like autism in women, autism in girls, ADHD, autism in ADHD in girls, ADHD in women. Whoa, brain fog is kicking in. if people have that on their website or on whatever profile you're looking for, I think it would be just a fantastic way to book maybe an initial call with a neurodiversity coach. That's what I offer. I also offer free calls for just getting kind of some vocabulary and structure and like an action plan. Do I struggle with maybe my diagnostic report? Is there something I don't understand quite yet? Or do I want to go for a diagnostic process and I want someone to kind of help me understand whether that's a good step for me? I think talking to an expert, and it's often for free anyways, is a good step. And then they can direct you to different resources, books, and maybe other practices and diagnostic assessment centers.
How can society empower or support neurodivergent individuals?
I think one amazing step is if we would look at public places and think, how could this place be improved? And then not just guess, but get a couple neurodivergent people, come visit your new train station or whatever is really like, you know, there are necessary things that have to be accessible. And I think just broadening the accessibility term from physical accessibility to neuroaccessibility, like, can we maybe change the light we have in here? A lot of gyms as well, they're just very like full on. Or airports. I walked through an airport once and there was a DJ blasting music in the duty-free zone. And those kind of things are, I don't know if neurotypicals really enjoy them, but they're not necessary, but they can actually mean something really severe for a neurodivergent person on that day, because traveling already is overstimulating. And if you just keep adding and adding and adding things to sell stuff or to make people engage with your brand or whatever it is, you can actually, can have safety issues for an autistic, imagine an autistic young adult who's traveling by himself and has a meltdown because the overstimulation just messed with his or their brain. So making places, shops, whatever, more accessible in a neuroaffirming way, like looking at light bulbs, looking at how loud do we want the music, is there maybe any non-verbal thing that we can give. I know some shops have, like, you can pick either a red or green basket to say I want to be helped or I don't want to be helped. This is one way. Yeah, oh my god, I could keep it on and on and on.
Brilliant point. Yeah,
neurodivergent people have so much within themselves that I think we just need a world where we can access it. And if we're constantly battling with inclusivity, then yeah, I think I would stick to the idea of if we're more inclusive and we're good at preventing meltdowns and overstimulation, then people will just naturally find their potential more easily because they're less in a survival state.
What do you wish or hope for the future of neurodivergent individuals in terms of accessibility or in terms of knowledge or in terms of accepting? What do you wish for?
I wish that we collectively understand on a very deep level that there are differences that don't equal deficits. I think if we understand that, that would be already incredible in schools and in whatever context, really. If we would really understand the core of what the neurodiversity movement is about, which is really communicating how we have just different neurotypes rather than there's one right type and then there's disabilities or learning conditions, well, also learning disabilities. If we understand that there is, that we are more like a bouquet of different neurotypes and we can learn from each other and use our talents, then that would be absolutely incredible. If we all just understood what's behind the terminology of the movement. Yeah. And then I think one more daydreaming wish would be to give neurodivergent people access to certain technology or products that make a huge impact, like noise cancelling headphones or stimming toys or soft clothing that really are necessary to maintain a regulated system, because there's such a big neurodivergent tax on things, you know. If you can't use public transport, you have to pay for a taxi. There's so many costs that come with being neurodivergent. And if there was some sort of system to close that gap also financially, I think that would be incredible.
Yeah, hopefully. hoping for the best.
Yeah, I can see it in your face. You're like, yeah, let's dream together.
Yes, because unless until somebody points out, you're like, oh my God, that is so true. And if you feel, I feel so, oh gosh, yes, something which is so simple.
Yeah.
It could be such a big task and you have to like plan ahead so much. It does take go. It is exhausting, isn't it?
Exactly. It is really exhausting.
Thank you so much, Micah. It was like really incredible to know your journey and to learn about this new world of synesthesia, which I hadn't heard before. So thank you so much for the share.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this and I loved your questions. I really had to think about things in a way that I haven't yet. And it's always amazing to having to explain a topic you think about a lot to a new audience and kind of pick your words a bit better. So thank you. I also learned a lot today and you're a joy to be around. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of Discovering Journeys. I would love for this podcast to reach as many people as possible. So please remember to subscribe, rate, and leave a positive review. Share this podcast with someone you think who would appreciate this conversation. Check out the show notes for all the links and details. Until next time, keep embracing your journey and discovering new paths.